Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives, coming at you from ACE 2026 in Las Vegas. My name is Diana Isaacs. I am with my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have a very special guest we've had before. We have Dr. Viral Shah, world famous in diabetes technology. So we're so happy to have you. And if you don't mind just introducing yourself, describing a little bit about your background in case there is someone out there that doesn't already know you.
Viral Shah, I'm a professor in endocrinology at Indiana University. And most of my work is focused in type 1 diabetes research, revolves around the technology, but I do pretty much everything in type 1 from a prevention side to complications. So that's my area of research.
Awesome. Well, we're so happy to have you here.
We're so thrilled every time we get to talk to you, right?
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
So at ACE, you have a talk on the use of GLP-1 in type 1 diabetes. And actually, I know that you've interviewed already with prevention of DKA. But we want to talk a little bit more because it came up today in a discussion around why would we use GLP-1s in type 1 and why there's some resistance from some people and where we are with that. And how do you feel about using it and where do you use it?
So we have lots of questions today.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to reframe those questions.
Yep.
And I feel like I agree that a lot of discussion comes around that these drugs are meant for type 2 diabetes. Why are we talking about using those drugs in type 1 diabetes? And I think a lot of providers or healthcare professionals are not comfortable having that, these people have type 1 diabetes, they cannot have type 2 diabetes. And I think there are some misconceptions around that part. So I want to be very clear that, like, if you think about the ADA scheme of the diabetes, we have a very clear cut definition of diabetes that you have a fasting plasma of X or prandial after OGTT, A1C, right? After diabetes, you classify diabetes into type 1, type 2, secondary, and gestational. There are four major categories of that part. You have a criteria for type 1 diabetes based on the antibodies. You have a criteria based on the genetics or some underlying causes, that's called secondary, and gestational, we all know that part. There are no criteria for type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is a diagnosis based on a phenotypical characteristic of an individual. It's a diagnosis of exclusion. So for example, I can run a test, an antibody in someone, and two islet antibody positive or one positive, I can say type 1. There are no tests in type 2 diabetes that I can stamp that this is type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, that's fascinating because I never really thought about it that way.
Right. No.
But you're right. There aren't any tests.
So for example, if you do C-peptide,
right,
and you can say, this person has good C-peptide, does not necessarily mean that it's type 2 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes diagnosed early can have C-peptide too.
Right.
And sometimes many years later, we might have a lower C-peptide, but we still might have some.
Exactly.
Right. That's very interesting. Also, you can have someone with longstanding type 1 diabetes with no antibodies anymore. So did I become type 2 because I've lost my antibodies? Right? That doesn't make any sense either, right?
Right.
So it's all very interesting.
And I think that's why the ADA standard of care is trying to clarify this topic again and again, but I feel like we don't read those small texts here and there, is that number one is that the classification of diabetes is not black and white. Okay, number two is that any type of diabetes does not mean that you cannot have other type of diabetes. They are not mutually exclusive.
Right.
So for example, someone with type 1 can have a phenotypes of type 2.
Absolutely.
Or someone, it's probably diagnosed as, let's say, monogenic diabetes and can have a phenotypical characteristic of type 2 as well, right? So those kind of different types or the phenotypes of diabetes can exist within one individual. And I feel like, at least from my standpoint of view, I don't want to say that someone has type 1 diabetes cannot have other types of diabetes. You know, I'm very comfortable in putting a diagnosis of type 1 as well as type 2 diabetes if that individual has some characteristics or phenotypes suggestive of type 2 diabetes. And it's a clinician's discretion, because there are no diagnostic criteria for type 2 diabetes.
Wow.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, because like when you put that perspective on it, then it's like, well, why would we use GLP-1 drugs in people with type 1? Because they also could have type 2 and they could be effective.
Right. I think we all know that if you want to get the GLP-1 covered in patients with type 1 diabetes. Either you can get it covered through either an obesity indication, or you have to have a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. And I think, as I said earlier, that most people with type 1 diabetes would have a lot of features of type 2 diabetes to make us comfortable saying that type 1, type 2 together, and prescribe either GLP, SGLT, depending on different types of indications, right?
So I think, like, to me, it's very clear. If someone has a BMI over 30 and they have obesity, even though they have type 1 diabetes, there's still a strong indication to use a GLP-1 drug. What about someone, their BMI is less than 25? There's no overweight or obesity. What's your take on that, on using GLP-1s in type 1?
That's a great question. And I think it all depends on the discussion between the provider and patient. What are the goals? What really we want to achieve here, right? Is that a glycemic reasons that we are using GLP-1? Is that something else? Is that a cardiovascular? Is that a kidney?
Right.
So I think ultimately it's a shared decision. I'm very comfortable if someone has a BMI about 25, because we know that then it's a GLP is going to cause some weight loss. But I do prescribe GLP and SGLT in people who have renal impairment, who have heart failure, who have a cardiovascular disease. Now, if they have a BMI 25, then I would try to use the lowest possible dose
to make sure that
we are not losing further weight.
Right.
Emphasizing about the nutrition, making sure that there is no muscle mass loss here, you know. But I would probably still incline to use that if there is an understanding on using that molecule for cardiovascular or renal related reasons.
And just stay at the lower doses. And if you see it, if you start it and you see it and they start to lose weight, you can always pull back. You can always go to an even lower dose.
Right.
And that can make a difference as well.
In those individuals, actually, SGLT would be much better than GLP.
Right.
You know, if the weight loss is the concern, then the SGLT would be great. And to that point, I think in 2024, when there was a sotagliflozin advisory board by the FDA convened that endocrine external committee, Dr. Patrick Arcadion actually presented to the group at the time to clarify that the use of SGLT inhibitors in people with type 1 diabetes for CKD is not an off-label use.
Because it's
he
being
clarified
used in
very,
CKD,
very
yes.
clearly
yes.
that if you use that for a glycemic indication, then it's off-label.
It yes, right.
So just again, I'm saying this is coming from FDA. You know, these are their own words that if you use that for CKD indication, it's not off-label.
It's good to hear. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think that's where we're trying to work between the lines of how do we protect. You know, people with type 1 diabetes have a higher risk of heart attacks, strokes. And we'd see the data in people with type 2. We have to do something. We can't wait for an approval under that label of type 1, which is very narrow, to give these people the medications that are truly have the possibility of saving their lives or extending their lives. And I think that's where but there is a lot of discussion. We had it today. I mean, people, I would never do that. And it's like, well, I have to, right?
Yeah, yeah. Another thing that I'm trying to now promote this idea and opinion, take that with a grain of salt, I think it's my opinion, is that the difference in type 1 and type 2 is the pathophysiology.
Yes.
But the disease course is the same.
Yes.
Why are we differentiating them? Yes, I understand that you have a lot more different treatment modalities available in type 2 diabetes. They're not going to be insulin dependent from the beginning.
Right.
But the course of the disease, progression of the disease, the beta cell dysfunction and loss over time, it's pretty similar between type 1 and type 2.
Right.
And so I think that I see a less difference between these two entities than actually more similarities.
Yeah.
As clinical practice has changed, it was like these are two separate things. And now we're getting to this merge part where it really is very similar.
Right.
Just different initial causes. So along those lines, I'm curious about, you know, staging of diabetes. And of course, with type 1, the stage 1, 2, 3. But type 2 diabetes,
you
know, has not been staged that way. We use this terminology pre-diabetes, And I'd love for you to share your perspectives on pre-diabetes and especially I know the increased cardiovascular risk. So yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I try to dig into the history of pre-diabetes and try to understand where this terminology came from and what are the reasons behind that part. And I think I learned that in that early 1990s or late 1990s, the pre-diabetes was introduced because the glycemic category were not clearly diabetes,
right,
not clearly no diabetes. You had some kind of a gray zone that you don't know what to call that. And also the study suggested that that kind of a glycemic zone or intermediate hyperglycemia, it's a clear risk for a progression to diabetes. So people started saying that let's put that word kind of a pre-diabetes, so something prior to diabetes, which is a risk factor for diabetes, to make healthcare professionals aware about this entity to do something, particularly lifestyle modification. But then the problem is that in this kind of like a terminology per se, because when you say pre-diabetes, you just feel like,
it's
you
fine.
Know, I
right.
haven't many years.
Right. I should not progress. Eat dessert on every Thursday. I should move more. I should.
Exactly.
But not really do, right? There's no
exactly.
execution, right?
Also think about that. The pre-diabetes, it's existing in our science for now 30 to 40 years.
Wow.
And tell me a single drug that has been approved for pre-diabetes.
Zero.
Right. You have a DPP that provided a level A evidence that the metformin can reduce the progression from pre-diabetes to type 2 diabetes. In standard of care, ADA, it's a level A evidence, but it's not approved
it's
by
not
the
approved,
FDA.
Right.
Why? Because there is no FDA guidance on a risk factor management, and pre-diabetes is considered as a risk factor, not the disease.
Right.
And I think it's a time to think about that it's a spectrum of the disease, rather than just saying that the disease starts here, and everything prior to that is no disease.
Right.
So that's
the fasting of 125.9 is not diabetes. It's nothing. And then 126 or greater is.
But the cardiovascular risk, can you talk a little bit about that pre-diabetes state and where do people who have pre-diabetes, what is their cardiovascular risk at that point already?
Yeah, so plenty of data. I think we have a tremendous amount of literature that clearly suggests that the cardiovascular risk in people with pre-diabetes is about 2 to 4-fold higher than people who have a normal glycemia.
Right.
Also, not just the cardiovascular, the risk for chronic kidney disease, risk of dying from any kind of a comorbidity or complication is higher in people with pre-diabetes than people who do not have diabetes at all, normal glycemia. What it suggests that, again, it's a spectrum where so-called healthy and you are moving towards kind of a little bit of a dysglycemic unhealthy zone to a very clearly unhealthy, right? In terms of the glucose I'm speaking about. And so I think it makes more sense to stage it.
Yeah.
And remember that part that we all are using the staging in every single thing in medical field. You have a heart failure stage.
Yep.
You have every single cancer is being staged.
Absolutely.
And why?
Kidney disease,
because
all of it.
Because I say someone, to any layman person, and say someone has a stage 2 cancer versus stage 3 cancer, what you're going to see?
We all know what that means.
You know
yes.
that the 3 is going to be bad than 2.
Right.
So I think the staging is not new into the medical terminology, and it implies that the disease has a spectrum where it progresses over time. And the progression denotes the deterioration in the underlying pathophysiology as well as the complications associated with that part. So I think we have a lot of evidence to really say that it's a time to stage type 2, similarly like what we did in type 1 diabetes.
Right, and it'd be nice to have medications specifically approved
exactly.
and accessible for that.
So we need to say that this is not a risk factor. Like pre-diabetes is not just the risk factor. It's
it
the
is.
Disease itself.
Right. Right.
Then it will open up an avenue for regulatory agencies to say, okay, let's now probably come up with some kind of a guidance.
Right. I'm just thinking of the implications, though. Like, I think if 38% of adults have, quote unquote, prediabetes, so that's a lot of people that now would have whatever stage 1 diabetes or type 2 diabetes. So that would affect a lot of people. It'd be interesting.
But it would also get them access to treatment.
Well, yeah.
Right? So that would be the whole idea of treating early, you know, would be the whole goal.
Right.
Right?
So there are two things to that, right? Number one is that do you really want to spend more money upfront?
Right.
Or do you want to spend even more money at the end? Right.
Right. Right.
So I think it's the choice of in terms of all the health economics and trying to keep people healthy, I think at least.
Well, anyway, metformin is a very low-cost medication. So if we can treat with lifestyle and metformin, it's not going to be, it'll probably save a lot of money actually
by
more treatment upfront instead of.
Absolutely. And,
so
and
you have two trials like semaglutide and tirzepatide that showed clearly a prevention from a pre-diabetes to type 2 diabetes.
Right.
Right.
It's already
Wouldn't that be great to reduce that, you know, weight associated complications of weight, preventing type 2 diabetes and complications of that part? I think that will have a huge economical implications down the road.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree.
It's not approved for pre-diabetes.
Right, exactly. But maybe it would be if we could do it as stage, you have diabetes, it's just, it's stage one, right? Stage one people with type 1 diabetes are all going to need insulin one day, right? That's the idea. Stage one people with type 2 diabetes
are at a risk is going to develop type 2.
And how we're going to, which medications we're going to choose would be the same algorithm we use now. Do you have a higher risk of kidney disease? Do you have muscle? Do you have, you know, what is your, you know, what is your cardiac calcium score? What is your, where are we with the rest
of it? It's a concept at this moment, but I think, you know, once we start thinking about that concept, we will come up with ideas, different ideas and research to really come up with the therapeutic plans, you know, to different things. Think about time in range and other things. When we started, we just started arbitrarily, but now we have amazing amount of the science to back that up, right?
Right.
There was actually in the type 1 diabetes talk today, there was an interesting question that came up about should everyone with quote unquote pre-diabetes, you know, the A1C 5.7 to 6.4 and other criteria, just automatically be tested for autoantibodies to see if perhaps they could actually have type 1 diabetes. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I look at that, there's two different perspectives. One is that the countries that has a socialized healthcare system, they have to think about that how much money that they're going to spend to find X amount of the people that could be intervened.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Our country is not that way. It's not a socialized. And I feel like nowadays the islet autoantibodies are available commercially at very reasonable cost.
Very low.
Like an Animal Bioscience kit, $50, right?
Right.
If insurance doesn't cover, then it's a $75 to $100. And I can say that many of my patients would be able to afford that one time because it's a one-time cost.
Yeah.
Right.
But the implication is a huge.
Right.
I can afford that $75 easily. But if I have two antibodies, then I think I would incline to do a teplizumab to make sure that I'm preventing progression to type 1. Otherwise, you will be completely like in a like space, blank space that you don't know what's happening.
Right.
You are thinking that this is just a pre-diabetes. It's I'm fine. And then
and
suddenly there will be hospitalized with DKA.
Right.
Now, take that with also a grain of salt that pre-diabetes after the age 60 to 65, only one out of three people progresses to type 2 diabetes. And there are multiple reasons to that. Number one is that somehow the hypothesis is that the aging kind of slows the beta cell function, and those people do have an intermediate hyperglycemia. So it's a part and parcel of kind of an aging. The second thing is that previous studies that have been done in these older individuals, the risk of developing type 2 diabetes is going to be far, far ahead than risk of probably unfortunately dying. And so there was a notion that after 65, probably we don't worry too much about the pre-diabetes in the past. But if you just say, let's say, leave that group alone, then I would say all these younger folks who are diagnosed with pre-diabetes in their 40s and 50s, I think it makes sense to do antibodies, in my opinion. But that's just my opinion.
Right. That is really interesting. I mean, that makes sense. And that would probably be at least economically also make more sense because then it's less people that you're screening up. I think especially in adults where type 1 is slower progressing, and we've seen so many misdiagnosis cases that it seems like at least we could catch some of those and then, like you said, intervene if possible using teplizumab or other future therapies.
I met with someone here within the ACE conference who said that he just tested as a just part of a curiosity and has two antibodies.
Wow. See, that's it. He's one of those one in 300, right? Yeah, that's walking around
well,
here.
I tested,
right.
But I never got my results. But I guess they're supposed to let you know if you have two. So I'm hoping
right, you're good, right. Right? Maybe we should redo that, right. Yeah.
So there are two ways that people can look at it. Some people would like to know what's happening.
Right.
Right. I think probably our personalities are more like
right.
that.
I want to
know.
As a scientist, right? You want. Right.
The other people is like, I'm afraid to see that.
Right.
And that's okay. I think everyone, has their own way of thinking about that part. But keeping that kind of the door closed for the people who wants to know the answer and saying that, no, you can't do that part because that's not a guideline. I think that doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
Right.
I agree with that. So, I think that we have to offer.
Yeah.
We cannot keep that absolutely as like, okay, this is yes, this is no. I think we have to be very flexible in our approach. The way that people would like to, seek the answer, Kumar.
Right. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of screening concerns, when people, I don't want my child to have what I have. Well, they might already have it. What we want to do is screen them to help you help them slow, like just a soft landing, whether or not they're going to infuse a drug or not infuse a drug. And I mean, until 2 days ago, it wasn't approved. It was 8 and up. And we were asking people to screen between 2 and 3 years old for really just to reduce that risk of DKA. Now that teclizumab is approved for 1 and up, it gives us a little bit more ground to stand on to say, no, we have an option beyond just we want to know.
Right.
The challenge is we're at such a different place now with the treatment of type 1 diabetes because we offer, our patients all go home on sensors. Right. If they actually have to get admitted, they walk out of that hospital with a sensor. A lot of them get pumps within the first 2 weeks or 3 weeks of diagnosis. Right. We're not that their history, the parents' history of severe lows and DKA and those kinds of things aren't what we see as much anymore. It does happen. Don't get me wrong, but it's a very different place. And it's hard to. That's a difficult conversation. Your diabetes history will have no reflection on what your child's history could be at this time, the potential at least,
right? Yeah.
That's the discussion I still struggle with some people still, right? Just because they're very, I don't want to know, right? And that we do get some of that.
Yeah. We respect, it's fine.
Yes, absolutely.
At the same time, I feel like the people who are, we are interested to, do that and learn about whether they have antibodies or not. And if we say that, hey, you have just a pre-diabetes, you are 40s, there is no indication for doing that part. That's also not appropriate.
Right.
That's where I struggle with is like that. Just don't keep that as like completely white and black.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I gotta run. It's on Modi to get 2:30.
Thank you so much.
He's gonna go do yet another talk. Right. He's leaving us.
Viral shot and wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue: Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.
Thank you.